This is a podcast from ABC Local Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Most Australian suburbs and many country towns have a community swimming pool. How important have they been in our social history, and how significant are they architecturally and culturally? I remember when I was growing up, all we ever wanted was to have a backyard pool. Some other kids at school had them. We were so envious of them. And there was a hierarchy too, because the in-ground pools were better. They were better than the above-ground pools. An above-ground pool was better than none at all, and certainly better than playing on a slip and slide or under the hose or under the sprinkler, which is what we had to do on a hot day. But just because I wanted a pool didn't mean I didn't dread the school swimming carnival as well, because I wasn't a very good swimmer. The swimming pool is now seen as something as of an Australian icon, and it has taken pride of place in our pavilion at the Venice Architecture Biennale. Michelle Tabbitt is the creative director of The Pool and is with us this morning. Michelle, good morning.
Good morning, Rod, and good morning to your listeners.
Thank you so much for talking to us about this. So who made the decision, or why was the decision made that Australia should be represented architecturally with a swimming pool?
The process of applying basically to have the honour to represent Australia for the Architecture Biennale is something that's managed by the Australian Institute of Architects. And my two other co-creative directors, Isabel Toland and Amelia Holliday, came up with this idea on a road trip down to Canberra that they wanted to represent Australia with something very singular but also very intuitive and very immersive. And the pool just kind of appeared and chose them. And then they approached me. So that's how it happened.
There's very little or very few things more immersive, you could say, than a swimming pool.
Yes, I bet the pun was intended.
I'm sure. So the pool itself, though, you know, that's an interesting thing because it's, you know, for most part, 50 metres long and whatever it is, 10 metres wide or whatever. I don't know how wide it is. And, you know, the bottom of the pool is painted blue or it's pebblecrete or something. I don't know. That's one thing. But then there's the whole thing about the architecture around what, you know, what pool we're talking about. What kind of approach did you want to look at? The design of the pool or the design of what was around it?
That's a really interesting question. In a way, the two are really inextricably linked. The water and the way that you interact with the water is, I guess, influenced by the way that the surroundings of the pool have been designed. And that's something that we considered in a lot of detail when we were designing the actual exhibition. So the actual exhibition in Venice contains a pool, 60 square meter pool, that's about a foot deep. And that it was important that we got the shape of that right and the depth of that right, and that that felt like a good body of water, but also that we got the surroundings, the different types of seating conditions, some of them on like on bleachers, others on a changing room bench, others on a chair, and that we encourage people to inhabit the water itself and the edges.
Well, one of the great lines about design or architecture is that form follows function. So if that's the case, will people be swimming in this pool at the Biennale?
Well, it's already happened, Rod. We were in Venice for the opening, which was at the end of last month. And to our great surprise, we thought people would kind of touch the water and, you know, just kind of get the tip of their fingers wet and just want to see, you know, what the water felt like. But actually, it just became this social space, just like it is back home. And little kids were asking their parents if they could get in. And we actually got a full-grown adult stripped to his, what I'm supposing were trunks.
What you're hoping trunks. Were trunks.
What I'm hoping were trunks. And he got in and he immersed himself. So people have this really interesting behavior, you know, they're in the middle of the Biennale, they're walking from one exhibition to the next, and they've all got some form of museum fatigue, and then all of a sudden they recognize this form and they take their clothes off and they get in, which was an amazing endorsement. You know, that's how we chose to look at that, because It was just amazing to see people, you know, love the space.
you know, unlike many sporting fields, it's designed, it has two purposes, doesn't it? There is the exercise, the competitive side of things in maybe an Olympic event, or just jumping in and splashing around. I mean, if you have a running track, you're going to be in a race. You know, if you're on a football field, you're playing, maybe just running around, but mostly you might be playing a game. But with a pool, there's two purposes, two meanings there.
Yeah, there's actually through our research and through the people we spoke to, we realized that, you know, there's these two major uses, as you've pointed out, but there's also a range of others. You know, there's sustenance in for an ecosystem in your backyard, around natural pools. There's also a spiritual meaning to pools, and that dates back to our indigenous history, but it's still very much, you know, present in contemporary culture as well. So the reality is, for a simple object, it's had meanings and significance in Australian culture, but also in other cultures, you know, like in Italy or in the United States. There are a bunch of bathing cultures that really take the pool as this important social space.
Okay. That is a little different in Australia. I know certainly in Asia, for example, in Japan or Korea, they've got bathhouses. That's an important part of their culture. In Australia, if you went to the beach or to the local swimming pool, once you are there in your swimmers, everyone's the same. You could be a billionaire, you could be someone with nothing. It doesn't matter. You're all in the pool together and there's no hierarchy. You're all in the deep end together, aren't you?
That's exactly right, and I think that's what makes the pool a uniquely Australian public space, and the way that the access is free and the way that the municipal pool is such an important piece of infrastructure on par with a library or, you know, with other municipal structures is really distinctly Australian, even though there are other strong bathing cultures. I completely agree with you there. And there's this sameness, there's this great leveling that happens even if you're an Olympic swimmer. You know, we worked with Ian Thorpe on this project.
Yep.
And he was saying that he trained when he was still training. He was training at municipal pools because that's where life happens. That's where his community is. And even though he was preparing for some of the most important sporting events in our nation's history, he was there with the rest of us.
I remember at the Birrong Pool in about 1973, this was in the sort of Bankstown area of Sydney, Jenny Turrell broke a world record in the 400 metres at the school swimming carnival. Now, that's an amazing thing that surely has not happened anywhere else in the world. And she had someone else, because the way it was, I think, in those days, at school carnivals, she had someone else swimming in her lane. She was not just there on her own. It was just the most amazing thing, the Jenny Turrell story. But then we've got this other side of things, and I look at, say, Western New South Wales, towns like Moree in the 1960s with the Freedom Rides, Charles Perkins, and he writes about that in the book, or at least his daughter does, and you've got quotes from Charles Perkins in the book that accompanies this exhibition or this display about how important it was to integrate the pools, which were white only in those days, and we don't like to see Australia as a country that was racist like that. We tend to think of that as South Africa or America, but it was like that in Western New South Wales, and the integrating of the pools was a really big thing, wasn't it?
It definitely was. And, like, you know, it was just amazing to be able to speak to Hetty, who is Charles's daughter. And she's also an Indigenous art curator. And she had worked around the concept of a pool for a while because it's a very pertinent episode in their family story. And, you know, the Maury episode was really symbolic. You know, as she would say herself, that event in itself didn't solve everything. You know, what she calls the disease of racism is something that, you know, we all need to work on all the time, but it did raise awareness like never before. And the fact that the Maury pool was the stage to this was quite significant because obviously the Maury pool is actually an artesian bath. It's a series of artesian baths, and they come out of the water comes out of the ground, and it's lovely and warm, and people go there for, you know, therapeutic and medicinal reasons. And there's people from all over the world there. But then when you start showing, you know, especially in the 1960s, that, you know, everybody's equal, but some people are more equal than others, that's a really important milestone in the nation's history to be able to, and we have that photograph in the book and in the exhibition of Charlie Perkins as he guided and basically shepherded through a group of young children, Indigenous children, who wanted just to have fun in the pool. And that moment is captured and really is a very important moment in race relations in Australia.
Michelle Tabbitt is our guest. She is creative director for The Pool at the Venice Biennale. You mentioned Ian Thorpe before, and he's writing in the book that goes with it. And he talked about the difference between indoor pools and outdoor pools. And most of us, I suppose, would have swum in an outdoor pool unless you go to an aquatic centre or something like that. But he talked about the difference there between indoor and outdoor, which was that there was a lot of noise in an indoor pool compared with an outdoor pool. I think at the Barcelona Olympics, which Thorpe did not swim at, it was an outdoor pool. It was a very beautiful pool on the top of the hill in the town, whereas in Sydney, of course, where he won his gold medals, it was indoors and it was noisy, and he thought it was nicer to train outdoors.
Yeah, look, Ian's just one of these incredibly perceptive, I guess, very perceptive, and he senses everything about the pool environment. So before he competes, he, as he says in the book, he would walk around the pool and try to understand, what is this going to feel like in training conditions, and what is this going to feel like when there's a whole crowd here. And the reality is that for someone like him, and Shane Gould is also involved in the project and comments about this as well, there's this ability in an athlete like they are to, really focus yourself within who you are and on what you're doing and block all that out. You can take the information in that you need to optimize your performance, but the rest you can block out. And then, in an Olympic pool, the Melbourne Olympic pool is an amazing example of that. The relationship between the audience and the water is incredibly important because the swimmers get their energy from the audience as well. So there's this whole infrastructure of indoor Olympic pools in Australia that are actually what we call theatres of competition.
Well, the Melbourne pool, of course, had the water polo as well, the Hungarians and the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War. And that famous semi-final with the picture of the bloke getting out of the pool with blood coming down his face. And it was a big deal that Hungary beat Soviet Union in that that event at the Olympics, because that was their way of, saying, well, we got one over the Russians this one time. And in fact, I think they won 4-3. After that, in Hungary, people would write on the walls 4-3 just to remind the Russians, we beat you.
And tying that back to Australia, I mean, one of the points that Shane makes is that the 1956 Olympics was really the putting of Australia on the global map. The Olympics were things that Europeans knew about and engaged in until then. And in 1956, when they were staged in Melbourne, it was really this coming of age. And it was all the Greeks and the Italians and the rest of the immigrant population who'd really made the Olympics something important in Australia. And conversely, Australia had become a global place. And that's really a massive shift in the nation's history as well.
Now, I'd love to read out some of these texts if you'd like to ring as well about your experiences with pools, because many romances started at the pool, particularly during school holidays. Now, that's the case, isn't it? It was a place, hopefully a safe place, that young people could go and meet the opposite sex, or the same sex as the case may be.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, John in Melbourne, I think it is. Boy, this is something we need to talk about, which is the ultimate irony, the Harold Holt Memorial Pool in Glen Iris in Melbourne. But where does that stand in Australian history? It seems bizarre to me that you would name a pool after a bloke who drowned. There's also, of course, Burke and Wills Fountain for two blokes who died of thirst. So where does the Harold Holt Pool fit in Australian popular culture, or just our public culture, do you think, Michelle?
Well, so the Harold Holt Pool actually was being built, and it was in his electorate of Malvern. So it was a municipal pool project that was designed actually by an architect who's still alive today, Daryl Jackson. And it's a fantastic example of brutalist architecture. I mean, whether you like that kind of thing or
I
not,
don't.
it's a very good piece of architecture. And the reality is he disappeared the week that it was supposed to be opened. And they felt like it was an appropriate nod or, memorial to him. And it's not the only memorial pool, but it's probably the only memorial pool to a prime minister who's drowned in office, which makes it quite unique. And a lot of people are quite surprised by the naming and find it quite ironic. But if you look at the context, I guess that's them. They were trying to pay homage to the man.
Yes, I notice also about Harold Holt and his memorial at Melbourne Cemetery. It says he loved the sea. I thought, well, the sea didn't love him back, unfortunately, with poor old Harold Holt.
Maybe not.
Also, there's a big David Hockney exhibition coming to Melbourne very soon, as one of our texters says. So, and David Hockney, not Australian, of course, but a famous British artist who worked very much in Southern California. He was famous for his swimming pool pictures. That's where he made his fortune. So there is a swimming pool culture in other parts of the world, but David Hockney really was a classic example of that, wasn't he?
He definitely was, and look, there's this interesting thing about Australia, which is we kind of straddle this kind of hybrid culture between a very British or colonial influenced culture, and then after the war, we really took on all these culture symbols and status symbols and products, and we really Americanized our culture. And one of the biggest examples of that, and one of the arguably the most popular exports from America was the idea of suburbanization, having your own block, having your house, having your pool, really privatizing all those things that you needed. And in the project, we talked to Christos Tsokas about this idea of having a pool as a status symbol and what it means to contemporary Australians, a lot of whom, come from maybe Greece or Lebanon or, other parts or Yugoslavia. And how that's a commentary on our country and its multicultural makeup today, and what status symbols are important to us today.
Okay.
So yeah, it's a really interesting relationship there between, the pool being a symbol of affluence,
Okay.
but also being an inclusive space.
Okay, well, Chris wants to talk about that. I don't think it's Christos Tsokas who, of course, wrote The Slap that a lot of people would have read or seen on TV, but Chris wants to talk about his migrant parents. Good day, Chris.
Oh,
Oh, it's Chris. I'm sorry,
it's
Chris. It's a woman.
a
I'm sorry.
female Chris.
Yes, I'm sorry, Chris. Tell me
Yeah, but
about your own
I'm
experience.
aware of that book, and it's a beautiful book also. No, my immigrant parents came not from Greece, but from Germany in 1967.
Right.
And the first thing they saw, or the first thing they always look at, is that beautiful flight path over Sydney with all the swimming pools.
Yep.
And they were so proud to be able to make a home in Australia that they of course bought a swimming pool, and my dad forever fetched leaves out of it ever since.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. What did it mean to you, though, coming from a cold nation like Germany, to have a swimming pool in your backyard?
Well, it was. I turned into a sea creature. I felt like being a dolphin because I discovered diving, and I am the proud record holder of 4 minutes 20 underwater doing laps in the suburban swimming pool.
Wow.
So that's not too bad. I mean, it's not the best, but it's not too bad.
Chris, thank you very much for that. So that was a symbol, I suppose, of becoming an Australian, that maybe something you'd never done before back in Europe. Michelle Tabbitt is our guest. Well, all of a sudden you could do that in Australia. You were becoming an Australian.
That's right. That's right.
Also, as Chris points out, just flying over, or maybe if you're going over along the train line or whatever, and you look down and you see all those pools in the backyard, it really is a symbol of suburban Australia. You got famous Australians talking about their pools, or talking about the influence they've had on the pools have had on them. Who did you talk to, or who was involved, or what did they tell you?
So we started by doing some research initially and just looking at what our research would reveal. And we had this inkling that obviously there was more than one meaning or one significance. And we realized as we were engaging our community to build this project up, we ran an Instagram campaign, and it's hashtag the pool Venice, and people started posting the images of their pools. And we just realized that actually it's not like there's a set number of themes. There's as many themes or as many stories as there are people, really. And so that's why we really decided on this storytelling approach. And we decided there'd be some very interesting people who'd have very specific things to say about pools. So we engaged with Tim Flannery, you know, the environmentalist, Australian of the Year. And he talked to us about the importance of the Great Artesian Basin as the life-giving force of our nation, but also one of the largest pools in the world. We talked to Ian Thorpe and Shane Gould as Olympians, but they spoke to us about slightly different things. Ian really talked to us about the in-depth sensation of swimming, and you know what that's like, and we touched on that a bit earlier on in the program. But Shane Gould really talked about this idea of performance and being in a theater of competition and what that looks like and feels like when she went to Munich in 1972. And since then, Shane has been doing a lot of work around the design of pools. She's better educated than any of us.
Yes.
I think she's working on a PhD around, you know, how you design inclusive spaces and what does inclusivity mean across ages, because the pool is one of those rare spaces that is as welcoming to a baby as it is to, you know, someone you know, in the later years of their life. So it's an incredibly inclusive space. So she's looking at what makes it that inclusive. We spoke to Anna Funder, the award-winning author of Stasi Land and many other books. And she talks to us about the pool as a public space, as this kind of semi-quasi-religious space where, you know, you find yourself, you find wellness, you find well-being, and you find your Australianness. Then Christoph, as we just mentioned, talks about that kind of status symbol role of the pool. But very interestingly, he also talks about the pool as a place of self-discovery. Being a gay man, the pool was one of the places where he understood his body. He understood that it was different to other, you know, Aussie kids. He was a bit hairier and a bit darker, but he also understood, you know, the desirability of his body and what it looked like to others. And so it's a really kind of personal account that he shared with us, which is just amazing. Other than that, we spoke to Paul Kelly.
Yep.
Paul Kelly talks about the pool as a metaphor for life. We all know his song Deeper Water.
Mm-hmm.
And the way in which, you know, for him and his family life, the pool was always a place they got together, but it was also the place of new frontiers. So it's where you go into more depth. It's where you discover a new aspect of your life. And he has a beautiful quote. He says, you know, love comes and love goes, and you know, big episodes like the loss of a parent or whatever, and it's all deeper water until you get there, and the danger is to not jump in. So it's this beautiful moment with Paul Kelly. And then finally we spoke to Romance Was Born, who are a fashion design duo based in Sydney and who base a lot of their creations on childhood memories. And they talk to us about, you know, the mundane stuff, but the mundane stuff is important to you. If that's the stuff that you hang on to from your childhood memory, like remembering that your swimming suit was threadbare or that, you know, you grazed your belly on the pebble creek, all these things mark us as adults, and we remember them really, really dearly.
Okay.
And then Hedy Perkins, of course.
Indeed. Michelle Tabbitt is our guest creative director of The Pool, or For The Pool, at the Venice Biennale. Another Chris says, we had the best of both worlds growing up. We had an above-ground pool with a deck on one side of the pool. The deck was 20 metres by 10 metres. Dad used to use the under area as extra storage, so the deck area made the pool seem like it was in-ground. And Steve says, I'm 60 years old from Cobar, far west New South Wales. I never saw a body of water
except for small dams, until the Olympic pool was built in town, and in the first 3 months it was always sold out. I learnt to swim the hard way by being thrown in the deep end, literally. Do you swim, Michelle?
I do, but I grew up in Europe, and we don't have the same swimming culture at all. So we did go to the pool, and I do have memories of a beautiful historic indoor pool that I used to go to where I grew up. But I couldn't compete with any of you, really.
Now,
so I like to be recreational about it.
All right. Well, that's interesting that you should say that. And we'll get to some calls in a moment, because Richard says, I never knew the pool was so complicated and intricate. For me, our pool was somewhere we had a swim. I must have missed out on something. Now, I think Richard might be a bit tongue-in-cheek there, but it's like any part of our life. Yeah, for some people, that's what it was. But for other people, there's a lot more to it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and that's what we uncovered, you know. I mean, you could say that about a lot of things. You could just take it at face value. But, you know, when we were talking, when Ian gave his speech in Venice, he said, you know, swimming is the only sport that we do as a matter of survival.
Mm.
There is no option.
That's
swim.
Interesting.
So And, it, you know, you don't have to play football for survival. Maybe running is about survival. I'm not really sure. But it was really interesting to see that it's about this human battle, or this human engagement with the elements that surround you. And so even though it just sounds like, oh, it's just a pool, it's just a body of water, that is true. It is just a pool. It is just a body of water. But it actually has all these different meanings. And we only uncovered 8. And this is what's great about your show and all the other engagements we've done on radio and other media, is that people keep adding to this, you know, keep adding layers, and there's many layers of people.
Okay, and someone else says the video for Small Town Boy by Bronski Beat is a great example of the role of the pool in gay male culture. Milo is with us. Good morning, Milo.
Hi, Rod. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. So what happened in the 1960s?
Well, my experience and memories that you've been talking about occurred from about the age of 10, and we didn't have, this was in Adelaide, we didn't have council pools at that time. We had people who built pools in an adjacent block to their home or behind their home, and that became the local pool. We walked up from school once a week, towels around our necks, and had swimming lessons. And then on the weekends, we went there for fun and social activity and so forth. And then the only, probably in the 60s, the only large council pool was the Adelaide City Council pool, which was on the city fringe, and that was a very big commercial swimming pool with high board towers, you know, the 5 and 10 meter and the springboards and so forth. And that was quite an experience, quite different from our local pool. And you know, as a sort of 15 teenager, you'd go along and experience that. And then I live in a suburb that opened a $20 million leisure centre 12 years ago.
Right.
That facility has a pool hall that is as big as an airport hangar.
Right.
It has three pools in it, one 25-metre lap pool, one square pool that the floor is able to be lowered and raised.
Yes. Wow.
And a wave pool, the first wave pool in the west of Sydney.
Wow.
So that's what's happened in, you know, from backyard pools that were, you know, not council pools, that were commercial operations that have probably cost 10 shillings to go in there and have a lesson and so forth, to our current facilities, which are magnificent and world class.
Okay, Milo, I might just get Michelle to comment on that, because that's so important, and thank you very much for those memories. That these days we don't have council pools, do we? We have aquatic centres, leisure centres. Is that going too far, do you think, Michelle?
It's interesting, because one of the insights I guess we got from looking up all these things, understanding what they were, was that a pool is a very expensive facility to run.
Yeah.
Actually, in Australia, it's not like you've got a one-size-fits-all or one-formula-fits-all, because you've got such variety in climate, such variety in humidity and water, hard, you know, softness or hardness. So there's a lot to contend with. And after the big effort of building municipal pools in the coastal pools, you know, between both wars, and then the memorial pools after the war, we found a lot of pools were finding, look, you know, this is quite difficult to maintain. It's exposed to the elements and so on. So councils were looking at innovating on the business model and thinking, okay, well, look, if we add a gym or aqua aerobics or a massage parlor or these other facilities, maybe the value proposition changes for the public. And in a lot of ways, I mean, there's some places where that's worked, I would say. And, you know, that's legitimate. But there's in other places where it's kind of been too much. It's added too much, and it's excluded people further because not everybody can afford $15 for a swim, or that kind of investment. So it's been a really divided thing, and it's been the journey that Milo who's just described is really one of an evolving relevance of the pool. And I think we're very much going back to, you know, the strict minimum at the moment, which is, you know, water, lanes, and that's all we need, really. Diving blocks are sometimes optional.
Okay, let's talk to Paul. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. How are you going?
I'm well. You got a pool in your own backyard when you bought a house?
No. That's an interesting question because I'm looking for a house.
Oh, okay.
And one of the things on the checklist is where's the pool going to go or has it got a pool?
Ooh. Why? Yeah. Why is it so important to you?
I grew up with pools and had a spa later on in life, and now I'm in a position to buy a house, and if it hasn't got a pool, it's got to have a location for a pool.
So is it difficult to find one these days? Are fewer people putting pools in their houses?
No, I'm looking in central Victoria in the country on a few acres, and I found that by having a pool, it doesn't alter the price, and by putting a pool in, it's not going to increase the price. But I find that I'd like to barter on the price to get it down a bit to allow to install a pool.
Uh-huh.
So I'm looking at a place today that it looks like it's got room for a pool, so it's all about the focus on where's the pool going to go.
So a lot of people say that, in fact, you know, having a pool does not increase the value of the house. You've kind of touched on that. Is that what you've found?
Yes, I've found that. Even talking to the real estate agents looking at the house saying, what kind of value is going to be put on the house in 10 years' time if there's a pool? And they say pretty much nothing. So it's not something you do for investment. It's something you do for either necessity or something you want. And kids love it.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And you touched on it earlier, that there's something about the romance of it, the status of having a pool, and bringing the family together.
Good point, Paul. Thank you very much for that. Michelle, one of the things people say, though, it's a bit like a boat, and that is, you know, there's two good days, the day you buy it, the day you sell it. You know, if you have a pool, sometimes it is tough. It costs a lot to run sometimes with the electricity, that you've really got to want that pool.
You really do, and there's, you know, running costs, but also potential leaks and things like that, and you know, much aligned to what Paul was saying, sometimes having a pool can be a negative. You know, sometimes people, when you're selling or buying a house, you know, people will be like, oh, God, I don't want to take that on. Obviously, there have been examples, and we included some in the book, of people who just fill in their pools, make a veggie patch out of it, you know, do something different in the backyard, either because they have other solutions or they're not all that interested in it. But it is a costly exercise. But now the technology for those types of pools is really evolving. Tim Flannery talked to us about how he turned his pool into a frog pond, and that he lets nature keep it clean, and he doesn't have to throw buckets of chlorine in there and, you know, spend his weekends cleaning and picking leaves out of it. It's nature that takes care of it. And those are really interesting models for architects because we're always interested in how to improve our lives and improve our well-being.
Indeed. Okay, we've got some callers we've desperately got to get to in the next 14 minutes, including William, who's got a great story. G'day, William.
How are you?
Yes. What's the situation? You were in Hollywood, were you?
Yeah, I was a pool man out in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Cleaning all these fantastic pools. Some of them had rivers leading to them, and we'd have to take all the rocks out of the river.
Oh.
Clean the river. That would come in waterfalls, And I went to Errol Flynn's old place on Mulholland Drive.
Wow.
Just as they were knocking it down. It wasn't to clean his pool or anything. They were knocking the house down with Justin, what's his name? Timberlake was there now.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's a gated community.
Yeah.
But back then, they were knocking his house down. The pool was still there. So I snuck in over the big fence and had a look at the pool, which was all green and slimy. And took a couple of the tiles that were laying next to it and brought that home.
Right.
So I've got some light blue tiles.
Uh-huh.
But all the pools I ever saw didn't compare to the best swimming pool I ever saw, which was when I was a kid. It was an above-ground pool, and the whole neighbourhood used to go and swim in it. It was just always full, making whirlpools.
Wow.
It was much better than any of the pools I saw in Hollywood.
Any other stars that you saw their pools in Hollywood, William?
Well, not really, because I don't know who these people were, but
they were
mainly sort of executives, not sort of the stars.
Okay.
The stars have live-in staff to do that type of stuff.
Uh-huh.
Except we used to have Leslie Ann Warren, some minor actress.
Yeah.
And I remember the first day I had to do her pool, in brackets, was a name describing her, which wasn't...
Okay, we'll go no further than that then. But thanks, William. You've got framed those Errol Flynn pool tiles?
I've still got the pool tiles, yes.
You need to get them framed. William, thanks very much for that. Celebrity pools, that's something you haven't spoken about, I suppose, Michelle?
Well, not really, no. But I think it falls in that kind of status thing, you know. I think everybody can try to show their personality through their pool design if you've got the means and the will, and it's quite interesting to see how much they vary from place to place.
Okay, we've got another celebrity one. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. Gunnedah, prior to this Second World War, Boy Charlton is trained in the Namoi River for the Olympic Games by swimming against the current.
Well, he swam in the 20s. We're going back that far.
Yeah, that's going that far. But after the Second World War, Gunnedah got built a memorial swimming pool. It has a feature wall with three services in it. But it was largely built all by voluntary labour.
Yeah.
I know my father cut the timber. Another, Les Griffiths, carted the trees to the sawmill. The Eather family cut the trees up to the timber. And they had a huge working bees and things. But now... this pool is, there's also been an indoor pool, but it's now going to cost about $8 million, I think, to redevelop this, because we've got to have 8 lanes now instead of 6 lanes.
You've got to have 8.
Do that?
Yeah, God, otherwise how is Gunnedah going to host the Olympics, Tom?
That's right, yeah.
Exactly.
There was a big argument initially. The pool was to be built near the town hall, near the shopping centre.
Yeah.
But it was decided to build it in this old disused quarry, which was really on the edge, over the railway, on the edge of the housing part of the town.
Yeah.
And so this disused, rubbishy old quarry was turned into an Olympic swimming pool.
Beautiful. Tom, thank you very much. Michelle, heard you laughing away at that.
Yeah, I'm just on the fence on that one. There's a lot of pools that are quirky, you know, because of, like, you know, the Dawn Fraser Baths in Balmain. I mean, they're just mad. They're nuts. They're, you know, you think about what's involved in running that place and the shape of the pool. It doesn't comply to an Olympic facility, but it's got so much character. And in some senses, an upgrade can be about maintaining that and conserving it for future generations.
I love the fact that many of these pools are memorial baths to the war. The one, I think, in Townsville that Laurie Lawrence's father ran, and they the Australians trained there for the 56 and 1960 games, I think, which fired Laurie Lawrence's love of swimming. And that would have been exciting, so exciting when those big stars came to town. John, good morning.
Good morning, Rock.
You would go back to the early 50s and Sports Illustrated.
Yeah, they came out in the early 50s and did a story on why Australians were so good at swimming. And of course, in those days, they went and checked out John Devitt, who was at Manly Baths.
Yep.
And then, of course, they went down to the Spit where Sam Erford had Murray Rose training, and then up to Balmain where Dawn was. And, of course, it was all in salt water. And I remember the Conrad kids, they used to come down to Sam's place down at the Spit. But the end of the article, of course, the American concluded that we were so good because we trained in salt water, because in those days that's all we had.
Yes,
and I'm not sure when the first indoor pool was built.
North Sydney pool was built, I think, after the Harbour Bridge was built.
Yeah, right.
So that would have been maybe in the early 30s. Michelle, sorry, go on, Michelle.
It's in the early 30s. It was built for the Commonwealth Games, the Sydney pool.
Oh, yeah, 1938 Empire Games, yeah.
Yeah, Empire Games, yeah, sorry, yeah. But just going back on swimming in salt water, we also spoke briefly to Dawn when we were preparing this project, and she was talking about how she used to swim against the water that was being ejected from the White Bay Power Station, and that water was just slightly warmer than the rest of the harbour water. And that's how she was fighting against that current and that stream that was coming out of the power station. And I asked her, did you have a photo? And she's like, we didn't take photos back then. That was very cute.
Ed wants to talk about Sydney Harbour pools. G'day, Ed.
Yeah, g'day. How you going?
Good.
I grew up at a place called Rod Point, which is on Iron Cove, which is part of Sydney Harbour. And we had, on Iron Cove, we had two tidal pools. They were built out of turpentine timber, like fencing with a 3-inch gap. And we swam there every morning before school and every afternoon. And our fathers used to have working bees on a Sunday morning to replace some of the timber. And the other thing that we used to do, of a night we'd go down there and we'd prawn nets and prawn inside the pool.
Inside the pool?
Oh, there was always the worry of the bull sharks.
Oh, dear.
When we were kids, we called them grey nurses, but they were bull sharks, you know. And there was one at what they call Miller Street, and the other one was on Rod Point, where the sailing club is there today.
Indeed. Ed, thank you. That's a story that I'm sure we weren't expecting, Michelle. Although I do want to ask about danger. We've got two more calls we'll get to in a moment, David and Enid. But pools can be very dangerous. We know about, you know, the tragedy of children drowning or even adults drowning in backyard pools as well. That's something that we really need to keep in mind as well.
Yeah, look, I mean, there's definitely been a lot of tragic losses, and that's really terrible. And I think it's important that everybody remembers that, you know, if you're at the pool, don't be there alone. If there's kids around, don't take your eyes off of them. Don't jump in. It is a danger. And pets as well. I had a dog who fell into a pool and he was never the same. Yeah, under the cover, but it was okay. He was all right. He just was nervous around other people being in the pool afterwards. But, yeah, it is a dangerous environment. I think, learning to swim, doing childhood swimming classes, and my two co-creative directors have young children, and the swimming aspect of it in the learning to swim and how to behave around water and what to do and what not to do is a really important part of becoming a child and an adult in Australia, and it should continue. It's being done well.
Okay. David, good morning.
Good morning, Rod. How are you going, mate?
Well, you want to talk about ocean pools in the 50s and 60s?
Yeah. I was born in Darlinghurst, mate, and we used to go down to Rushcutters Bay Pool, and occasionally there was one at the Domain too. Very dilapidated. In the low tide, you really didn't want to go in because of all the mud and the mud slush in the bottom.
Indeed, yes.
High tide was like heaven, mate. they had a slippery dip there that was metal, and in the really hot days, you'd burn your bum on it. It was that hot. And it was a good thing, multicultural, because the Croatian and Yugoslav guys used to play water polo there.
Yeah.
And it was something to watch. But it was a great thing for us, being born in the inner city areas, Rod, to be able to go down to, we used to call it Rushy.
Yeah.
And we'd walk past all the people who had more money than us that had the yachts. and so forth, and then we'd get to Rushcutters Bay Pool.
Well, in the water, we're all equal, aren't we, David? I hope. Thank you so much, David. I'm sorry, we're just running out of time. Although now, of course, we've got the Boy Charlton Pool there on Sydney Harbour, not at Rushcutters Bay, but around near the gardens. That looks spectacular. And I think it's Enid or Enid, our final caller this morning.
Olympic Pool in Roma, yeah. As far back as I can remember, and I was born in 1934.
Right.
And there was an Olympic swimmer called Denise Spencer.
Right.
That came from Roma. And that pool was well used and was very nicely set up. There were tiered seats and lawn around. And, oh, they used to have carnivals. I can remember one of the funny things I remember, they used to have men used to have pillow fights on the greasy pole,
oh,
as it was called.
Indeed.
And, yeah, but I can't remember what year it was, but as I said, it must have been the early 40s. Okay. And that was very well used, and that was lovely. And I loved it because they had the hot showers. I used to spend a lot of time under the hot showers.
Very good point. Thank you very much for that. Michelle, finally, what should we think about? How should we think differently about pools?
I think we need to realise that they're an important social space, you know, just sit down and take in and use it as an opportunity to socialize and see its importance. The same way we have, you know, there are piazzas in Italy. We have the pool and we need to continue to value them. And I think if we think of them as social spaces and public spaces, very central public spaces, we probably want to keep them in a more minimalist way, in a more democratic way, and make them as approachable as possible. And I think that will continue to define our nation into the future.
Okay. If people want to see more about the Biennale and our contribution to it, what should they do?
Well, so we've got the book that you mentioned a few times is on sale. It's not very expensive. You can find it on Manic at Books. And we've also got the eight broadcasts of the eight people we spoke to that I mentioned earlier. Those can all be found on Pocket Docs that is being hosted by the ABC. And so they'll be broadcast every so often as well. So you can hear the voices and you can read the book.
Okay. Michelle Tabbitt, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed it.
Not a problem. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michelle Tabbitt, Creative Director for the pool at the Venice Biennale. And thanks to all of our phone calls as well. Well, that's another podcast from ABC Local Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Thanks for listening.